Carol's on. Is anybody else? Hi, Carol's on. Who just joined?
Rick Wasner.
Hey, how are you doing, Rick?
Pretty good.
Good. You've been staying busy?
Oh, yeah. That time of year.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's just you and I thus far.
Cheryl,
yeah.
How much? How flooded did you get in that rain?
We actually didn't. Oh, we were very lucky there.
Hello.
Hi. Who joined?
Dinah.
Hey, Dinah. That sounds wonderful. Who else joined?
And Dana Abernathy.
Hey, Dana. Welcome.
Hey. Thanks.
We don't have. I was hoping to start with Ann Stewart. I think we'll give it another minute or so, and then we'll adapt as needed. Dinah, I'm glad you were able to join. Dinah is on her way to Japan tomorrow?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, indeed.
Is it for an intern?
FBI ride.
It is a
what?
Ride.
Yeah.
Are you officiating or riding?
Officiating.
Okay. Who just joined, please?
Ann.
Ann Stewart. Sounds good. This is Cheryl.
Hi, Cheryl. Are we the only...
Hey, Ann.
Hi, Dinah. Are you packed? Or do you ever unpack?
Good question.
Just don't unpack. It's simple that way. Just
well,
the entire suitcase in the washing machine, and then the dryer, and then you're ready to go.
Yeah, but I have to bring different stuff to Lexington than Japan, so... There is that.
What stuff?
I was wondering whether you were planning on attending Lexington. You are?
Yeah. I go
when
straight.
When do you get back?
Yeah, you're nervous now, aren't you? I'm flying into Lexington on Sunday.
Okay. No. Did that make sense, the coordinating of the trips? Or?
No, none.
Okay.
He never told me anything. He says that sounds great. Well, what sounds great? I don't know when he's coming in or what.
You know, I've got an itinerary on my computer, but I'm not at home right now. But I can email
it
to you.
Yeah, it's just that he needs to catch up with me because I'm going to be really brain dead.
Right.
So.
But you'll be able to get emails over there.
Yeah, I should be able to.
Okay. Well, I hope I remember to do that tonight. In fact, I'll write myself a little notita.
Well, or just bump him.
Just bump him?
Yeah, tell him to send me his itinerary, this silly man.
He is about as bumpable as my little brother.
He
can bump your head all day long and get nowhere.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
Then you have a big knot on your head.
Yeah.
Oh, if I could find a pen, I'm in someone else's office. This is very disorienting.
Well, if I don't pick him up, the only reason is because he never bothered to send me. I mean, you know what?
Mind?
You know what I'm going to
do? Hey, guys. Can I interrupt this a second?
Yeah.
It's Jeff Pauley. I may be going in and out of coverage, and I'm traveling back from Lexington. So if you lose me, I'll call back in, okay?
No, we won't lose you. You'll lose us.
There you go.
We're sitting still.
All righty then.
Be all your fault.
I thought I send him. What I'll do is I'll send him my itinerary.
Okay.
And he's just going to have to conform to me.
How far is the airport from the venue?
I have no idea.
I don't.
I'm not. I mean,
it's not
I don't
right
mind.
There.
I don't mind picking him up.
Back in Lexington, maybe Jeff's got a clue as to how far the Lexington airport is.
He just, you know, he didn't say. He just
it's not very far. It's within an easy taxi cab drive.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so.
Because I thought it was the Northern Kentucky Southern Ohio Airport or something. It's not necessarily in Lexington.
Oh, I'm flying into Lexington.
Okay.
Yeah, but...
Well, that's what they call it, but...
No.
Yeah, but you can drive from Lexington to Cincinnati in 45 minutes.
Okay. We're fine.
Yeah.
Somebody can run and get him. If it's a totally wacky time difference, somebody can
get
him.
Okay, yeah, well, if I have his itinerary... I can even tell you, Ann, what mine is if you find any way to write. And then
gotta be a pen in this office. There's an entire drawer of cat.
You have some members on this call, incidentally, so we should probably get launched pretty soon.
Oh, we do? I thought it was just
questions.
You guys don't want to know about the cat treats. I'm just writing myself a note, Donna, and I will email it to you.
Okay, because I'm going to be not in touch as of tonight. I mean, I leave very early, and I have no time between flights, so
okay,
I won't
fine.
Be getting anything for days. I was just going to tell you when I get in, if I can find it. But go ahead with the meeting, and then if I can find it, I'll just whisper it.
Okay. Just so that people know, Dana Abernathy's on, and Rick Wesner. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Rick, I'll get
hi, guys.
Hi, guys. Sorry, we didn't know you were there. We're just blabbing away.
And just so that everybody knows, I'm on, Ann Stewart's on, Donna Rojak's on.
Hi there.
And Jeff Pauley's on. So I think we've got enough to get going, and we'll take it from there. I know Ann Ayala is definitely planning on coming, and Steig is planning on coming under pain of he's up in Washington, so he's doing business stuff, unfortunately. But worse comes to worse, we can... ad hoc on him. I can cover for him. Yeah, try that one for a joke.
I think I was first up with the health stuff.
Yeah, with the healthcare stuff.
And I've got gigantic topics. So
yeah. What
I thought I'd do is just hit the high spots and maybe one at a time, and then if people had questions, then ask away, because otherwise we'll be too mind-boggled by the end. So the first thing is just basic preventive health care, and the main thing that always comes up is vaccinations, and that refers to, with the FEI passports, to influenza vaccine. And the irony of the whole regulation of the influenza vaccine is, from an immunological perspective, it really doesn't make sense the way they regulate it, but they regulate it, and we have to follow the rules. So what they want is a flu vaccine. They need an initial series, which has to be greater than, let me make sure I'm getting this right. The initial series is not sooner than 3 weeks apart and not greater than 90 days apart. So most horses in their lives had initial series of vaccines when they were babies. And this used to be a giant nightmare for us. And what they've done is modified it so there's a wording that can be found on the FEI website where your veterinarian can just write in a passport that this horse's vaccinations are up to date on schedule to this point. That's not the exact wording, but that's the gist of it. So once you've got your initial vaccination for influenza series documented, then the next thing you have to do is maintain their vaccination. And the simple way it used to be was just do it every 6 months. Actually a little less than 6 months. So you actually sometimes have to count days because months aren't necessarily 30 days long. So you have to be careful with that. And now they've tried to make it easier on us, which is actually more confusing. So if you're not competing that horse in FEI rides, it's okay to do it once a year. But then when you start competing again, you have to get them within every 6 months. So what I tell people to do is just get it every 6 months. Because for one thing, you don't have to think that much. And for another thing, the immunity to influenza, which is the whole reason we're vaccinating horses, lasts 6 months at best. So that's flu vaccine in a nutshell. And
it's Dinah.
Yeah.
The other little snag is you cannot give the second of the series within 7 days of the competition.
I don't think you can give any flu shot within 7 days of the competition.
Right.
Well,
and
the flu is the one I'm talking about. The second one of the series is the only one that matters. But, yeah, any flu shot, you're right.
Yeah, so if you were coming up on 5 months and 3 weeks and wanted to give a flu shot, and I just had this question emailed to me the other day from a team rider, you know, they're going to be within 6 days, their horse will still be okay. But from my perspective as a regular old veterinarian in the world, I have a little bit of worry that that horse isn't going to be very protected, and I hope he doesn't get sick. But as far as what his passport looks like, he's fine. So his immune system versus what's stamped on a piece of paper don't necessarily correlate. And I wish maybe that horse had a booster a few weeks ago, but now we're getting too close. And I just wrote the person back and said, you know what, you're fine, don't worry about it, because I didn't want to get anybody paranoid. But one reason why they don't want a vaccine within a week of the ride is because when we give your horse a vaccine, the whole reason we're giving them a vaccine is to boost the immunity. But what really happens is 2 to 4 days after giving the shot, the immunity goes down. There's an immunosuppression. It's transient, meaning it goes away, and then it goes way up and boosts the immunity. That's why we call it booster shots. And meanwhile, in that week before the event, if you were to give the shot sooner than that, you might bring an immunosuppressed horse to the event. And you'd be hanging around a bunch of other stressed horses and viruses flying around and everybody in barns together, and it's kind of a nightmare. The other thing is they can get a sore neck or a sore rump or wherever you give the vaccine, and the hamstrings, the chest, you know, wherever, they can get muscle soreness, and you don't want that before an event. So those are the practical aspects of it, to not vaccinating too close to an event. So that's all about flu. There's other vaccines, and I think all horses should be pretty darn well protected before they go into a venue. I mean, there's stories.
If we were to sort of go down the list of, you know, A, B, C, A plus B plus C plus D plus E.
Yeah, a lot of it depends where you're coming from and where you're going. But there was a big ride out west some years ago, and there was somebody leading a horse around with snot pouring out of his nose, and I think that horse drank out of every water trough in the place. So that was a big disaster and a lot of angry people. But, you know, hopefully everybody was vaccinated and, you know, we were as protected as we could be.
Yeah.
So as common as influenza, so anyway, if you've got flu under control, you've got your passport under control. So that makes the FEI happy. But then the reality of immunity is what's your horse going to be exposed to? And in transportation, shipping, the other respiratory virus you have to worry about is rhino. And that's usually a respiratory form. But there's this other evil strain out there that's a mutant, virulent neurologic strain, which we've always had around. But it's the thing that closed the racetracks and it closed showgrounds in Florida. And it can occur anytime there's a bunch of horses that get together. So I like horses to be immunized against rhinopneumonitis, you know, really every 3 months if they're going to be stressed. And the vaccine isn't all that protective against the neurologic form, but it keeps the virus out of the population more often than not. So I recommend rhino vaccine. And you can do both of those vaccines intranasally or in the muscle. It depends how your horse reacts to things. So those are the main respiratory bugs. Rabies, you guys probably should do. I remember talking to veterinarians from, like, Colorado that say, oh, we don't have rabies. We don't vaccinate against rabies. Well, now there's a big human exposure from a horse rabies case reported in Colorado. So it's kind of everywhere. And it's fatal to horses and fatal to humans, so you should do it. Let me see. Tetanus is also a no-brainer. That should be done every year. And then if there's any kind of an injury where tetanus toxin might attack that poor horse, it should be boosted within 6 months. And they're always getting little cuts and scrapes, so we do it whether they need it or not every year or every 6 months. And then there's the mosquito-transmitted things. Encephalitis, there's eastern encephalitis here. There's western encephalitis out west, with also some eastern, and then Venezuelan is along the Gulf Coast. But Venezuelan encephalitis can be a little bit of a mess with quarantine and international transport, and they're better about it than they used to be. But if you don't live on the Gulf Coast, I probably wouldn't give the vaccine just to avoid potential problems with quarantine and blood testing. And West Nile virus is on that list of the mosquito-transmitted encephalitises, encephalitides. So West Nile usually gets cranked up in the late summer and fall. So we like to give it in the spring because there's mosquitoes around, and then sometimes boost it again in the fall just because that's when there's actually more risk of West Nile virus. And then there's other miscellaneous things depending on where you live, like Potomac horse fever, like botulism. And that's just all sort of an individual thing you have to discuss with your vet, depending on where you live, whether you should give those vaccines or not.
How about strangles?
Strangles, I think they should be protected against strangles. And I like the intranasal vaccine. I hated the intramuscular vaccine to the point where I refused to give it. It was dangerous and would make abscesses and wasn't all that protective. But this intranasal vaccine, Pinnacle, that is out, is protective and safe in the relative scheme of things. If your horse has had strangles in the past, then you probably should have a talk with your vet about it. But there's still not the risk of the secondary disease called purpura hemorrhagica. That's this immune-stimulated problem that they can get if you vaccinate a horse that's had strangles in the past, and it's sort of a disaster. So you should definitely let people know if your horse has had strangles before.
And would you do all of these things so that you don't do anything in the last week?
Yeah, nothing should be done in the last week for all of the same reasons. Anytime you give a vaccine, there's transient immunosuppression and there's potential for muscle pain.
Can I ask you a question? It's Dana on the strangles. I have always thought that, and I have always done the strangles vaccine, but I had a vet not do it one time because they were more concerned about some irritations to the windpipe versus the actual horse getting strangles. They felt like it caused irritations. Have you ever heard that before?
Well, sometimes they get a little bit of a cold. It's like when you take your dog and get the Bordetella vaccine up the nose.
Mm-hmm.
They get kind of sneezy sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's happening is they're making an immune response.
Okay.
And it's not as bad as if they got strangles or they got kennel cough.
Yeah.
But so you're sort of seeing what you want to see.
Mm-hmm.
But for that reason, that's a great reason to not do it close to a ride.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
So you have to really study the calendar when you're looking at these things, and that's going to tie into when we talk about Legend and Attaquan, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I just threw a bunch of information at you guys. But that's
Anne, it's Dinah. I just wanted to ask a question about titers. I was told that sometimes, you know, you were also saying that Venezuelan influenza.
Venezuelan encephalitis.
Encephalitis.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, dead here. Is in parts of the United States. It's a bit of a risk. And if a horse has a titer pulled before they give the shot, is that a good idea?
To see if they're protected or not.
Well, more if they ever want to travel abroad. Won't they have some kind of a ghost of something from the Venezuelan shot, the VEE shot? Somebody tell me that, and I just wanted to clear it up.
In the old days, you would, okay, if your horse had been exposed naturally to Venezuelan encephalitis or vaccinated against it, they couldn't differentiate through the blood work which it was, okay? So it was a positive titer. And my understanding is now they can differentiate between a vaccination titer and an exposure titer.
Thank you.
So that's why they've lightened up on the rules. But you know what? I don't know if I would trust some bureaucrat with a clipboard in some foreign country. I mean, I hate to be this way about it. But, I mean, you know people have gotten in predicaments internationally traveling over these things. So unless I were in an endemic area, and Dinah, you may be down in Brunswick, you know, you may have exposure there. I don't know. I think you're right around the area where you might. I don't know if you guys have talked about that down there.
Well, I'm diligent about giving encephalitis shots because people can get it, so I worry about that too.
Mm-hmm. Do you give Venezuelan?
No, never, because of the traveling issue.
Right.
I didn't realize there was a change.
Well, yeah, it's a theoretical change. I think you're probably smart to keep skipping it unless there's an outbreak around, and then you have to make a decision.
Yeah, maybe pull it tighter and then give it or something. I don't know.
Right.
Okay.
So the thing is, when you take your horses to an endurance ride, most of the time we're well ventilated and we're outside, but that's the most stress they're going to be under, and so their immune system's going to be down, and that's the most exposure they're going to have, and that's a classic time for horses to get sick. So they should be as protected as they can be when you get there.
Second topic, ulcers.
Ulcers is a giant topic, but in AERC, they can't be on omeprazole, and they theoretically should be off at least a week before competing.
A week?
Oh. Yeah.
So it was like 3 days.
Well, it depends on the drug test. The drug tests are very sensitive, and every individual animal metabolizes drugs differently. So we don't know necessarily on any individual horse what the withdrawal time is, which is the safe period when they can be off of medication. So the average horse might be 3 days, but what if your horse has a slower metabolism of that drug? So your safest at about a week. Now, if your horse has active ulcers, you probably need to just treat them for a month, have them scoped, treat them for a month, rescope them, make sure they're gone, and then you can do preventive stuff like there's papaya products out there, there's brewer's yeast, there's Nalox, there's feeding to keep
Nalox
roughage.
Work?
Huh?
Does Nalox work?
Well, it's the stuff called Nalox, like Nalox.
Oh.
And, you know, some people swear by it. I don't know. It hasn't been studied, but it would neutralize acid in the stomach. It's not going to stop the secretion of acid like the medication does, but it would neutralize it. And then always keeping roughage in the horse's stomach is probably the best thing you can do for them as far as prevention goes. A lot of us don't know if our horses have ulcers or not. So if there's any suspicion, it's worth taking a look to see, because it's expensive to treat.
Just thinking about taking a look, I know we've had this discussion, but maybe not everybody has. There's this Succeed test nowadays that it's like if that comes back negative, I think it's pretty much you don't worry too much about ulcers.
Right, but if it comes back positive, there's potentially false positives.
Then you go ahead and do all the other stuff.
Yeah. Yep, and that's a fecal blood test, just like they do on humans.
Yeah. And it's
a nice tool to have. But the best tool is looking in their stomach. That doesn't tell you if you've got colon ulcers, which is a whole other can of worms and difficult, if not impossible, to diagnose. But there can be colon ulcers in horses that are kind of a nagging problem and can be a really terrible problem in some horses. But the main thing there is nutritional management, I think, with any of these guys. And that's basically having a roughage-based diet.
And when they're in stalls, they should have hay in front of them?
Mm-hmm. All the time. And I think that, you know, there's a sloshing factor when you guys are on the trail, bombing down the trail, and there's acid sloshing up into the portions of the stomach that aren't used to seeing stomach acid. And if there's roughage in the stomach, that helps neutralize the acid and actually physically soak it up some. So it's not a bad idea if you could snatch a bite of grass here and there next to the, you know, the water puddle that you're drinking out of. Let them go ahead and snatch a couple of bites. It might help.
Do you have any notion how much it takes to sort of provide a base? Is the couple of bites?
A couple of bites is better than nothing.
Yeah.
But they have a pretty small stomach. Like, if it's stretched, it's the size of a, you know, a basketball if it's really distended. So for the body size of the animal, they're pretty small. It's more like those little kids' soccer balls that are sort of half the size. So think about, you know, how much grass chewed up in there. It's not that much. Their stomach is constantly taking in grass, and it's passing through the stomach quickly into the small intestine, so it's a constant flow. So you can't really fill their stomach that quickly and then go. All you can do is just, I would think, pick along here and there during a competition. And then, obviously, in the vet checks, let them eat as much roughage as possible.
Okay. Let's get on to the Legend and Attaquan pieces.
Legend and Attaquan, you know, they're debatable things. They're made to help rebuild damaged cartilage by being part of a, if you think about what the molecule looks like, it looks like an old, did you guys take high school chemistry, like a bottle brush? Like it's got a wire in the middle and then a round brush all the way around? The molecule in the synovial membrane looks like a bunch of these bottle brushes, or even the analogy has been like feathers, where you have different branches on the feathers and the little tines that come off, and then they get even smaller and smaller, and it makes this feather pattern. And so Legend and Attaquan work on slightly different parts of that feather pattern, where the legend is on the itty-bittiest little parts of the feather, and the Attaquan works on the next branch in, the next biggest branch. And what they're doing is replacing these parts of the synovial membrane that make hyaluronic acid, which is the lubricant in the joints. And what they found is these molecules injected actually do end up in the joints, and they do help the synovial membrane, and they do help rebuild damaged cartilage. They slow the process of cartilage degradation and indirectly have anti-inflammatory effects. So all those things sound fine and dandy, but then once in a while somebody will do a big study and it says they don't do doodly squat. So after spending all that money and thinking all this stuff through, you know, you have to scratch your head and wonder sometimes if we're really helping. And I think as much as we put concussion on our horse's joints, I like to use it because I think I'm getting something accomplished. And people, whether it's sort of an indirect placebo effect with humans or they're actually seeing a change, people swear, and I swear I've seen it in my horse, that there's a change. And the clinical studies that are done, some of them paid for by the drug companies, of course, show that there are benefits to using these things. Attaquan's done some really good science on it. So I think it's worth doing. There's different protocols out there for how often to give it, but one big word of caution is Attaquan IM is how it's advertised, named, labeled, marketed in the muscle can cause muscle pain. So we're running around pre-event giving Attaquan IM. I've been at two national championship level rides where horses couldn't go because the Attaquan made their muscles sore and made them lame. So those horses, right before an event, we need to give it intravenously. And a lot of people don't know you can give it IV, but you can. So right before an event, like 24 to 48 hours before an event, I would give it in the vein and not in the muscle for Attaquan. And Legend is always in the vein.
Would you do both Legend and Attaquan?
I'll tell you what, if the bottles are both there and people can afford to do it, I do it.
Okay.
I would recommend doing that.
Okay. Interesting. Nutrition.
You guys have any questions? I'm barreling through all this information. Are your
other things that people want to hit on, Rick?
No, I'm just following the flow.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you guys keep your horses on any joint supplements?
I've had my horse on my older horse on Attaquan, and I kind of like to ask a question on him. He's on an endurance horse, but he. He has these bone growths on his joints, on his long bones, his hock and his front knee. The vet's been calling them just bony proliferations, and sometimes
uh-huh.
they get sore, but they almost look like tumors.
Huh.
But it's bone, and sometimes he's lame, and he definitely doesn't have the fluidity that he had before these. So I'm wondering if the Attaquan or Legend would help that.
It probably would, because the stuff you're seeing on the bone, the proliferation,
mm-hmm.
is painful enough. Mm-hmm. But what you can't see on the x-rays is cartilage.
Mm-hmm.
And his cartilage probably looks pretty bad.
Yeah.
Really inflamed and probably kind of moth-eaten looking. You know, if we had MRI, which, you know, we do, but mm-hmm. I probably wouldn't do that just financially.
Yeah.
Force through it. But you might see some cartilage degradation, and if by the time you see bony changes, you've got cartilage degradation. So he would probably love to be on Attaquan or something like that.
So So would it, you would think the Attaquan, perhaps, or talk to my vet about Attaquan or Legend?
I would use Attaquan chronically. I think Attaquan is a better maintenance drug. I tend to think of Legend more as an acute injury type thing, and use Attaquan more for maintenance.
Okay. Okay. And that over something like Cosequin, what?
That is a good question. There's a big study that's just come out, again, that says that the oral chondroitin, any of those oral supplements, aren't working.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anecdotally, there's a bunch of people that take them, and there's a bunch of animals that take them, and everybody thinks they make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But they've studied it over and over and over again, and I think they're convincing me that those oral supplements are being digested.
Mm-hmm.
The molecules are being torn apart, digested, absorbed into the bloodstream, go through the liver, go back into the bloodstream, and then get to the joint.
Mm-hmm.
And the molecule is gone. It's just a little far-fetched to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you're injecting something in the muscle and it just goes in the bloodstream and then goes to the joint, that's a lot easier for me to wrap my head around than something being digested.
Mm-hmm. So that I was working with, Rudin-Riddle had suggested that similar, you know, that he said he wasn't a fan of the orals either. He was more of a fan of the, you know, the injections.
Yeah, and if you buy the stuff that's really quality, like Cosequin, I mean, Cosequin does regulate their product. Anything that's a nutraceutical as opposed to a pharmaceutical,
mm-hmm.
there's no regulation. They can tell you anything and put it on the label, and you don't know how much of what product is actually in that tub that you paid all that money for.
Mm-hmm.
Cosequin, they really do. They've tested it over and over again, and they really have what they say is in those tubs in there, in the appropriate ratios and amounts. But, you know, all those other products out there are not as conscientious about it, and they're expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do the math, by the time you've put your horse on any of those, the higher quality oral supplements, or at least we think they're higher quality, you could have bought a bunch of Attaquan.
Mm-hmm.
So I just tell people, you know, if you're going to do it, to buy the injectables.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I just think it makes more sense all the way around.
How about the injectable glucosamine that Dr. Fleming is selling?
I don't know what he's recommending. I wonder if I could Google that right quick. Is it the generic Attaquan?
No, it's the way I take it, it's an actual liquefied glucosamine, he claims it works. I don't know.
And he's given it intravenously?
No, intramuscular.
Huh. I wonder what that is. I'm sitting here in front of this computer. I think I can maybe Google that. What's the name of his...
Actually, I have it. I have Glucosamine Equine Health Resources. Our injectable glucosamine has been upgraded to a combination formula. So it looks like there is equinedoc.com/glucosamine.
Let me see if I can figure out this computer.
Well, while Anne's doing that, let's us push forward and hit on conditioning. I don't know if Stag joined. I'm assuming he didn't. But Dinah, do you want to sort of hit some highlights of what you would do on your conditioning? I've only got a couple of points that I want to make.
Gag, choke. Well, that's only a lifetime long. I would love to answer questions if there are any, you know, or people want to talk about their conditioning programs, but to just sort of describe what happens to a horse physiologically when you condition, there's no possible way to do that in, 10 minutes. So,
maybe, Dinah, you could just talk about peaking for a race and how you kind of do a
okay
curve. And
all right. Well, let's talk a little bit then about assuming your horse is brilliantly fit and you're maybe a month out from a race and everything is absolutely perfect. What do you do? Is that what the question is?
Pretty much.
Sort of?
Maybe even the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but the last month, what do you do? Is that sort of what you're asking?
I'm even saying what's the last 2 weeks. What are you doing?
Last 2 weeks are very different. So, well, okay. Well, so let's just go back a month because, I don't really think well in two-week increments. A month out, the horse would be working every other day, nothing extraordinary except perhaps some cross-training in the form of either dressage or fox hunting or driving or swimming or probably not swimming in public pools, but, you know, pond kind of things. Anything that the horse has done before and enjoys and is different to keep them fresh and sharp and maybe putting a little more into it than they might on a, you know, normal ride. And I wouldn't do the cross training more than once or twice a week. So we're every other day, once or twice a week, doing something odd, and then that's a month out. So now we're down to 2 weeks out. 2 weeks out, there's something called a taper that they've been using in human runners for quite a long time. And what it means is that you don't keep working hard right up to the moment of the race, that you actually let some rebuilding of the body occur. And timing the taper is an art form, and I think it really is an individual situation. I don't think I can say, you start tapering on 6 days out, and then, I think every horse is a little different. So if you've got a real couch potato, you may not be able to taper out as far as 6 days. You may be able to taper out 3 days. So you have to think about that. And what tapering means is you just tapering off work. It's pretty simple, and it also rarely happens because what we do is we get our horses fairly close to the ride, and we think, okay, we're going to taper. Oh, but we really can't because we've got to drive, 1,000 miles. So we throw them in a horse trailer and jiggle them 12 hours a day, and, that's not tapering at all. So anyway, so those are some of the things I think about. What I don't do is I don't cut back food, and some people do, but our horses are out 24 hours a day, and if my horse was stalled or partially stalled, I might consider cutting back on food if I am cutting back on work at that point. I don't feed any feed with sugars, so I'm not quite in the same boat as people that are feeding, really high-carb, sugar-rich sort of foods, if that makes sense to anybody. Our horses are pretty much forage eaters, some whole oats, lots of supplements. That's basically it. So it's really pretty boring for them. So food is not like a real high priority in their lives other than they need to do it. But what I want to make sure in the last couple weeks that the weight, the horse is actually almost in, and it's not going to happen, but you have a sense that they would gain weight if you had them off for maybe two more weeks. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. That they're not losing weight. Mm-hmm. You don't want them losing weight. I need to be very careful about what's called overtraining, and especially as you're getting very close to that race. There's something called an overtraining syndrome in humans, and they do feel it exists in horses also, where you actually start getting higher pulses, the horse starts losing interest, and humans start losing interest in food, they begin to become lethargic, they lose their zip. So I'm balancing it the whole time. Do I have the zip? Do I have the joie de vivre if I turn the horse out? Does it run through the pasture looking, with its tail up over its back, looking fantastic? I can't give you a formula, but I can give you some ideas of what I look for. And one is not a loss of weight. Another is the horse joyful? And what else? I guess those are really it at the end. And it doesn't mean I stop working. They're still going every other day. But maybe short surprise rides. What I mean by a surprise ride is something where they think they've worked, but they really haven't. Like going up a steep hill, but it's only a mile and a half long, and then maybe coming down easily, another, 3-4 miles. And they think, wow, I really worked because I went up that hill fast, but they really didn't. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I would like to sort of just give a little bit of sidelight, perhaps. If you have the opportunity, and not everybody does, and you're looking at a particular ride, you'd like to do at least some of your conditioning on a course that looks like the terrain that you're going to be riding on. It's sort of a luxury if you can, but it's certainly worth thinking about.
But that's, to me, that would be way early. I mean, for instance, going to Argentina, we rode on the beach a lot. We rode in the water a lot because that's where we were going to be riding, but I started that months early.
Yeah, and some of it is...
So that it was no big deal.
Yeah.
I don't want any surprises in that last few weeks. I want it to be just mellow city, you know, working along, but no big surprises that last few weeks.
And
I want them fit and rested.
Yeah, and I know, thinking in terms of, like, the last hard work, at least for my guys, is typically, like, 10 days out, and it's 2 weeks. 10 days is the closest in that you do your last hard work.
Sounds about right.
And
yeah, that sounds about right. 10 days to 2 weeks. It depends on the horse.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
Matthew won the Old Dominion and then went out and won the Tevis. He really emphasized that he had done a hard ride the 7 days before.
Yeah.
Each one of those.
I think it really depends on what
yeah.
you know, your individual, and you've got to know your horse. So. And they really, it's true. There are no two horses that are alike. It's really frustrating, but it's fun.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at Barney's website, and sorry, there's not enough information for me to make any kind of judgment. It's kind of confusing.
Well, that's honest.
Yeah. Attaquan is polysulfated glycosaminoglycan. So that's a mouthful. We call them PISGAGs for short. So Attaquan is PISGAGs, and what Barney's got here is that whatever this product is glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate. And he's got what's in Attaquan. He didn't spell Attaquan right. But it's just, I think he's trying to generalize so much that I can't decipher it. So, sorry.
Well, I'm going to say something that maybe I'm going to get in trouble for, but I'm going to say it anyway. In exercise physiology, one of the things we learned is that there's a huge difference between PISGAGs and GAGs.
Right.
And maybe everybody needs to know that.
And if you're in organic chemistry class or biochem, you know, how many sulfates are hanging around on the end of your GAG? You know, if you're polysulfated, you know, it's probably important for getting into the synovial membrane. And I'm not a biochemist, but I can tell you that any little nuance in your shape of your molecule is really, really important. So that's your biochem class for the day.
So are there any questions about conditioning that I can answer? I mean, that's just such a hard subject to do in no time. That's good.
Yeah, one other thing that is, this again gets back to the you start things months ahead of time. Again, if you have the luxury of doing this, think in terms of using another ride to point to your real ride, and that other ride on as close to the same type of terrain as what your real target ride is.
Yeah, and you can look at a whole year or a whole career in those terms.
Yeah, that's true. I've been thinking in terms of, you know, well, if you're pointing someplace and you're taking a 3-month range on it, you know, yeah, you've got a whole lifetime, a whole career, but at the same time,
well, how about we play with Kentucky? That's sort of a real life scenario.
Yeah.
If I was getting ready for Kentucky, and I had a horse that was already very fit, very sound, ready to roll a month ago, this is what I would do. I would ride that horse every other day. I would do maybe, I personally would do some dressage with it. I might, if it was a rational horse, I might do some fox hunting with it. I definitely would keep it on the schedule. I would watch very carefully whether the weight was holding well. And if necessary, I would go to 3 meals a day, and along with hay if necessary, especially right now where the grass is changing. In our, we're in Vermont, and our climate is, you know, we're approaching winter up here, so our grass is getting to be, you know, straw, and so we have to think about the nutritional value there. So I might be increasing with some good second cutting, looking for, you know, some healthy calories to get into them. So we're talking probably riding 3 to 4 times a week. The couple of those weeks are going to be at least twice a week in the ring, serious kinds of dressage stuff, not you know, let's see if we can get our horse on the bit stuff, but actually making them use their backs, trying to get them to bascule, trying to get them to step under, trying to get them to step sideways, trying to get them to walk in place, you know, do stuff that will stretch and move muscles in ways they haven't been moved a lot. So in those first 2 weeks, they may be a little sore from what I'm doing. And then when I get to those last 2 weeks, not so much of that. More rest, short spurts, and I don't mean hard gallops. I mean, let's canter up this hill kind of thing. You know, I'm looking for maybe a pulse of 170, not a pulse of 210. And then, you know, easy on back home, maybe trails I haven't been on in a long time, that kind of thing. It's more keeping them fresh and keeping them ready and watching them very, very carefully.
And wrapping them in bubble wrap so they don't get hurt.
Well, that's a part of why you stop the dressage 2 weeks out.
Yeah.
And Dan, do you want to hit on any sort of fat supplementation or anything?
Just that, again, is a complicated topic, but the thing to think about is if you want to have fat stores in the horse's body and think mainly in terms of the liver, you need to get that on board months before your competition. And
does it make sense to sort of think of that as season long?
Yes, because most people, you know, it depends on what your plan is for the year, but you can do it season long. And I think our horses should eat relatively high fat and relatively low carbs. So, Dinah, I don't know if you're doing, do you do fat supplementation in your supplements?
Yes, we do. That's part of the deal. How did you know? And wheat germ.
Because it's the best way to go.
The issue with fat, and this is, you guys probably already know this, but I'm going to say it anyway. Horses don't have a gallbladder. I know that most of you know this. And so the gallbladder is a fat. It works with fat. That's its job. And so when you feed a horse fat, it's not like they can just handle it. So it does take a really long time for them to adapt to it. Not to mention, they don't all love it.
Yeah, it's not like you turn up your nose and...
Yeah, and you know,
horses.
So then we start screwing around with things like rice bran. Now, I have my own little hang-up here, and I'll put it out there, and then you can beat up on me. I'm not into feeding things to horses that horses don't eat. You know, and I've never seen a horse in a rice paddy eating rice bran. So my feeling is I would rather, you know, trick them in other ways and probably not be feeding them large quantities of things that they don't normally eat. So I do. I feed flax oil because they will eat flax willingly, and it's great for their coats. And I don't take them off. I mean, they're on it year-round. When you were saying seasonal, I wasn't following. Do you mean you some?
No, I mean if you're thinking about if you don't generally feed fat, and you say, oh my gosh, I've got this big race coming up in 2 weeks, and you want to start feeding fat, it's too late.
Yeah.
You have to do it months ahead of time to get stores in the liver, and then you have to maintain those those stores by continually feeding fat.
Yep. And some people, I'll give you an anecdotal one. We had two horses, and Ann knows these two horses very well because they've been on several Pan Ams when she was the chef. And they're half brothers. And if one gets a high-fat, low-carb diet, he looks fantastic. And he goes very well, and, you know, everything is just jolly as the dickens. And if you do exactly the same thing to the other horse, and these two horses are the same age and live in the same pasture, if you do exactly the same thing to the other horse loses weight, loses condition, and starts looking like a rack of bones. So I don't know. I don't know. It's really interesting, but they do metabolize differently, just like they sweat differently. They sweat different compounds, you know, different amounts of compounds, so different electrolytes.
So when you're feeding fat, just make sure that it's stabilized, because it gets rancid, and not only does it taste really horrible, worse than it started out, for the palatability issue, it can just be unavailable to them nutritionally. So make sure you get some sort of a stabilized fat. And that probably translates to don't buy the cheap stuff. And smell it. I mean, you can smell your supplements, and if they smell bad, they are bad.
And I personally don't think there's anything wrong with corn oil. I mean, I don't see it as an evil. Some people have a problem with it. I've never quite understood what the big deal is about that. Maybe you have some thoughts.
Well, the talk in the nutrition world is about the ratio of omega-3 versus omega-6 fatty acids.
Oh, for sure. For sure it's not as good as that, but as far as just plain old FAT.
Yeah.
I mean, FAT is FAT, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
I guess if you're going to get nitty-gritty, you're probably better off if you get canola oil. It's
okay.
Probably your best over-the-counter plan if you're not going to get flax oil.
Where do you get flax oil? Well, I buy a product that's called DAC, DAC oil, and it's actually a mixture of wheat germ and flax. And I actually like wheat germ also because it's pretty high in vitamin E, which is another thing horses kind of need when they live the way we have them living. And so you get sort of good stuff on both sides. Straight flax oil is, you can do it, get it from the health food store, but it is really expensive. And there are people that will spend hours and hours and hours out there soaking their flax seeds, too. So, you know, your call.
And there's powder.
Remember, when you put it outside of a seed, you're damaging it.
Right.
It's going to degrade really fast.
And platinum makes a good product, but, you know, you can't order giant tubs of it, but it's stable. But the platinum products aren't cheap, but there again, you get what you pay for, and they are good products, well-researched, and huge teams of researchers on those products.
Okay, moving along. Shoeing.
Jeff, are you still there?
I am.
Well, did you get the email that's 70% slippery grass in Kentucky and 3 miles of pavement and then some dirt track?
Yeah, I knew that, yeah.
You left out the slippery word, Ann.
So what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
But to me, the best shoe for that scenario is concave with the pin nails in the heels. And also on the lateral side, there's a lot of turns in this ride, I understand. And I would use 2 pin nails on the lateral side, 1 on the medial. I'd go with the second nail hole back with a pin nail, and 1 in the heel, and just 1 in the heel on the medial.
Can you tell me what the pin nails are?
They're a French nail. All it is, it's got a little tungsten traction pin right in the middle of the head of the nail. And it doesn't give you enough traction to, I think, stop the slide, the normal slide of the foot. So I don't think it's going to get them joint sore, but it gives you enough to give them more confidence on the terrain. And concave shoes has a rim. The outer rim is higher than the inside rim. They also give them good traction in grass.
I'm a little worried about that grass.
Well, grass in the morning with morning dew is going to be slippery, and it's also going to get slippery at night.
Yeah.
During the day, it should be not an issue. But concrete shoes, it shouldn't be an issue. Cheryl has run. I've put concave on Cheryl's horses before, and they really like it for traction. It's good. It's good in also mud. And if it rains any, that grass will turn to mud.
Yeah, it's going to be churned up like crazy.
And you know, equitation is going to really play into all this. How people ride those turns.
Yeah, and the asphalt, I think is up to the rider. You cross the road 14 times, and I think anyone that is riding responsibly, it shouldn't be an issue. If you kind of get redneck and want to race on asphalt, then take your life. There's no horseshoe that's going to help you.
Is this... I think in some senses it's somewhat obvious that you shoe for the ride. Now, in your training for the ride, would you be shoeing the same type of shoes, or would you be?
No, it's not going to change the horse's way of going enough to where I think you should have to train in the shoe. I personally think it gives them enough traction just to keep the horse confident in his footing. If a horse loses confidence in his footing, he changes his stride. And if he changes his stride, then you're looking at probably muscle soreness because he's moving in a way that he's never moved before. That's why I think on this ride, traction is the most important thing over all else, whether it be concussion or whatever, the asphalt. I think you're looking at 70% of grass, so I'm going to shoot for that 70% of the race. The other 30%, it's going to be a rider discretion to be safe in that 30%. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and about how far in advance, the perennial question, how far in advance do you shoe?
I like 10 days prior, but, that's just I think it's the optimal time, and sometimes that's not always it's always going to happen. I don't like shoeing the day before the ride, but if a horse loses his traction, doesn't have a good shoe on it, I think it's a good idea to go ahead and shoe the horse the day before. But the optimal time is 10 days prior.
The other thing you can do is just replace some nails, couldn't you, for traction?
Well, those nails are a knee hip nail, so if someone's got a shoe on there that's punched for city head, it's not going to work. It's going to stick way up, and it's going to give them too much.
Huh.
I use a shoe that accepts city head and e-head, but it's never an issue with the shoes that I nail on a horse's foot, so I can change in the shoes that I put on. I can change nails at any time, and they work.
Uh-huh.
But there's a lot of shoes out there that are cheaper shoes that people buy that are not interchangeable.
So you're saying your nail heads are too fat to fit down in the shoe?
Exactly. It won't seat in and then it'll work its way loose or cause problems with as soon as they hit asphalt or something. It's going to be sticking down, a quarter of an inch, and it could hurt or injure the horse.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions, Dana? Rick?
No.
No.
Okay. And I'm looking at this stuff and thinking in terms of what makes sense as an order, and this was more in stream of consciousness. The final touches and presentation, what I was thinking there actually was I'd read an article, I think it was in the Sarah newsletter, but evidently it was a reprint of something that Becky Hart had in the Endurance News about, in effect, getting the horse actually doing the trot out and how you practice for doing the trot out. And
And we always end up practicing trot outs at you know, world championship rides. Everybody's trying to learn how to trot their horse.
Yeah.
And it's enough
Anna
to make the staff
Dinah are the best ones, and maybe Jeff, but Ann and Dinah definitely are presentation gurus here.
And we work on it and work on it and work on it, and I don't think you can work on it enough. We always try to trot our horses after a conditioning ride just so it's just normal to do it. And mistakes I have watched people make are changing trotter handler at the last minute and changing headgear at the last minute. So I would say don't run to the porta potty when you're vetting your horse in for the world championship and have your husband trot the horse and make it head bob as they're trotting along and jerking on the lead rope. That's always a mistake. And not to put on some pretty new fancy halter that maybe even feels different to the horse, or a new lead rope with a different buckle. Anything they're not used to on their head, I just wouldn't change a thing for a trot out. It needs to be whatever they're most used to as far as handler and tack goes. And it's a horse show. You know, you've got to present them well, and when you're in the vet checks, they have to be presented well, and then if you're lucky enough to get to BC, that's really when it becomes a horse show. So you've just got to look at every little detail in presentation and be sticklers about it. It does make a difference, and horses can look lame when they're not, and I've seen it a lot of times, from being on the control line and being on the team side, and you just want to tear your hair out. Because you know a lot of the time they're not actually lame. But, you know, if they're head bobbing in front of you, what do you do? So there's always, always, always practice that. Can't do it enough.
Dinah?
When you say you're just talking about just the basics of just going, trotting out and trotting back. Is that?
And doing circles and doing it without pulling on the rope.
Yeah. Okay.
They should trot right next to you with called a loop in the lead. There's just a little bit of slack in the rope.
Yeah. And
just let them go.
Yeah.
There's tricks.
To look willing and fresh, perky, as if this is all their idea.
Yeah. It's interesting because it seems like such a simple thing, but it doesn't sound like it is.
It's not, and it's so important, and nobody pays any attention to it.
Interesting. Good point.
Yeah, and it's amazing the difference it makes.
Can you guys hear me? Oh, I thought I lost you. Sorry.
Yeah.
I just had this, Dinah. I have one comment because I'm not a trotter outer, but I sure have seen a lot of good ones and a lot of bad ones. And one of the things you can do, even if everything else is done wrong, is you can present your horse looking like you give a damn. And I know that sounds odd, but if you have two horses walk up there and one who's got sweat caked all over its face, and, you know, I'm talking BC here, it just looks like nobody bothered to clean the horse up. The vets aren't judging the cleanliness, but it does give the horse and I think Cheryl used the word, a perkier look when they don't have sweat completely caked around their eyes. They just look better. They look like you look better when you change your clothes. So if you can actually think presentation on all fronts, not just how good your trot out's going to be, but on every, and your manners, the whole nine yards. And I know that sounds funny, but I honestly have seen where it has made a difference when the rider was kind of rude. And, well, am I wrong?
No, it's true. I mean, you have people walk up.
Really?
And I have been on both sides of it a million times. And people walk up and they are a mess. And the horse is a mess. And, you know, I don't care if it's subliminal, but the veterinarian standing there is thinking to themselves, this person has problems. And I think it's subliminal, but I think it's true.
And actually, to tell you the truth, it was an FEI vet, not Ann, but another FEI vet, who said this at a clinic one time. And I thought, wow, that's very gutsy to admit that you're affected by the fact that somebody brings up a slob of a horse. So anyway, just think about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's such a little thing, and you can do it. You can
wipe out their nostrils?
Yeah.
So it doesn't look like there's, you know, is that blood coming out of their nose? Or, you know, if this, wipe it away and go talk to your crew about it later.
How about getting the scour off the back legs, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, the vet doesn't have to look at it and say, well, gee, that horse is scouring. I wonder, you know, I mean, they're just, you know, there's things you can do, little things, and it's not going to hurt the horse to be cleaner. So.
Yeah.
That's a for what it's worth.
Dinah, I know you've done infinite amounts of competitive trail and maybe a bit less. And Jeff, you've done showing, I know. Do you bathe horses before bringing them to rides?
If it's a rational thing to do. I mean, if it's 30 degrees and raining, you know, I might not.
Mm-hmm.
If it's 75 and the horse is covered in, you know, crud, probably. I personally think that a lot of pack situations, I don't do it just because I think they're cute, clean. I mean, though they do look better. But I think they get fewer tack issues if they're clean.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that whole Queen Girth area thing.
Yeah.
And we used to have an old bag living around here, and she, if you put a horse out in a field with a saddle mark on it, she would come up your driveway and ream you out. So I guess I learned early on, you know, don't you be putting the horses out with a girth mark on them. It's just, you know, it's just lousy horsemanship. And should it matter? I don't know. Does it matter? Yes, it does.
I like to hose them off. I don't like using soap and horsey shoe.
We don't, on a daily basis, we rarely use soap. When we go to a ride, what I might do, and it's probably illegal, but maybe it isn't, is I would use something like Meliseb, some kind of antifungal, and make sure I rinse really, really well just to cut down on anything that they might be getting near when I get there. Have you ever used Meliseb?
Yeah, it's not illegal because it's not going into their systems.
Good, good.
That's interesting because I know when we went to the North American in Fair Hill, both Cam went along as a companion animal and Super was the horse being raced. They both got rain rot. And Cam was ugly.
What time of year was that? I can't remember.
It was the fall.
About now.
This is a terrible time for rain rot right now. It's terrible.
Yeah.
It is a terrible time. Did I tell you? Let me tell you, I got a cure for rain rot, guys. You'll love it.
You're going to get the Nobel Prize.
Put a sheet on them.
That's crazy.
Honestly, I've tried everything. I mean, we've even put old motor oil on horses trying to get rid of rain rot. I hate it. I've tried every old wives' tale known. I've tried all the medicines, you know, and all the antifungals, and I've even done sodium iodide drips on them. I mean, I've been there, I've done that, and for the last 3 years, when it rains, before they get wet, we put a rain sheet on them, and we have not had rain rot.
Is it totally, are these rain sheets totally waterproof rain sheets?
Yeah, they're pretty waterproof. I mean, they're not 100, what is, because it runs down their necks. But,
yeah.
You know, basically their butts are dry,
mm-hmm.
and they're, you know, along their spines are dry.
Yeah.
And, you know,
that's what matters.
It works. I mean, it's a pain in the neck. We got a lot of horses, but I'd rather do that than treat rain rot. I mean, treating one horse with rain rot is at least as much work as putting blankets on 25 horses.
I wonder if that would work in the South with heat and humidity, because
I wonder.
Much of our problem is humidity. Like this time of year, everybody's getting that little itty-bitty short, dense winter coat.
Yeah, that's what we get.
We're getting days that are in the, you know, mid to high 70s, and horses get sweaty, and it's like golden retriever hot spots. They're just.
But is it rain? It's not 70 when it's raining, is it?
It can be, yeah.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
That's not good.
But it doesn't even have to be raining. We can be in a drought and still have rain rot.
Oh, really?
It's from moisture trapped against the skin. So I don't know.
Oh,
depending on where you live, it might, the sheet idea might not work.
Yeah, you're
but
right.
But it's interesting.
That's definitely interesting. I've got bunches of sheets, and none of them are waterproof, but hey.
What, you know what they make?
Good.
They make a spray.
Yeah.
I'm
just kind of, you know, hey, Thompson's Water Seal works fine.
They make a spray, and it works. You know, you spray it on, you know, you get it at like Cabela's or one of those guy places, and it works. You spray it on the thing, spray it along the seams, and hey, I don't care. I don't care. If I have to put blankets on for a month, I'll do it just to keep the rain, you know, keep them from getting it, because I just can't deal with having to scrub off and pick scabs, and I don't know how bad you've had it, but we've had it to where we had to body clip, and even clipping off scab, it's disgusting.
Oh, yeah. I've seen a horse have so much serum and pus oozing out of their skin that would dry in the shell, so there would be like a shell of this hair shellacked layer and then space and then skin under there, and you could knock on it and hear a hollow sound.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Now,
that's hard to clip off.
Was that owners not taking care of their horses, or was that just something?
That's just something that by the time, I mean, you walk out there one day and they are covered in it.
Oh.
And that's just the way skin works, is you'll get down in your hair follicles, you get a skin infection, and weeks later the truth comes out to the surface. So what you're seeing when you say, oh, my God, suddenly my horse has rain rot, it probably started a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's necessarily neglect. What I think it is well, at least this is all experiential, believe me, because I have no science to prove this. This has just been a move of a desperate woman. I think what happens is in this time of year, they get that short, dense coat, and we really get some serious coats up here, as you can imagine, and then they get little gooey under it, and then it rains, and they sort of get a layer of the, you know, the, we call it scruff, you know, the white sort of oily stuff that they have in their coats all winter.
Mm-hmm.
You guys get that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what do you call that? Is there a vet word for that?
I don't know, dander.
Yeah, it's just sort of greasy. Anyway, they get that, and then it sort of creates this barrier, and we find that it happens the most with horses that are not ridden every day. Now, go figure.
Well, it makes sense because their circulation isn't all that great if they're not getting their hearts pumping. And
hmm.
It's probably the key there is circulation to the skin surface.
Yeah. But I'm fighting a rain rot right now, and I can relate to what Ann was saying about it's like almost a shell appeared on my horse's butt, and I was wondering, because it rained one day and he was shivering and shivering and shivering, and it was like 70 degrees and he's shivering.
Well, he probably got a little chilled, but probably what you are experiencing now started way before that day that it rained.
Yeah.
It's when he blew out. You go out there and groom them, and it's summertime, and it's like, well, why is my horse shedding like mad? They blow out their summer coat. They grow in this dense winter coat that traps moisture, humidity, sweat, dead cells, the scruffy stuff Dinah's talking about. And then they're like a hairy dog with a hot spot, and that's exactly the analogy. It's a moist dermatitis.
Yeah.
And the crazy part is I truly believe that a sheet, I'm talking sheets here, would not work, because I'm creating, you know, a dark environment. And isn't that what a fungus would love?
Well,
for whatever reason,
part of it, but air is important. And if you've got a waterproof, breathable sheet on, I bet you you're accomplishing just exactly what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, and these are Gore-Tex, so.
Yeah, so if you put like a rubber sheet on them, you'd have a lot more rain rot.
Yeah.
But as long as
but all I know is it works. And I mean, honestly, when we resorted to motor oil, I said we got to figure out something better than this.
I knew you were a redneck all along, Dinah. I knew it.
Yeah, well, that came from somebody in England. They said, use motor oil, but it had to be the non-something motor oil. Yeah, non-detergent, the one that doesn't have a detergent in it.
Don't put this on the tape on the Internet. It can't be available for the public.
Well, it didn't work.
Well, good.
I can tell you that.
Okay, everybody listening, it didn't work.
Okay.
Moving to team riding. I think we've got the presentation. We don't want horses with rein up rod if we can avoid it. Team riding. And Dinah and Ann, you've been there, done that on multiple sides of this. So have at it.
Do you guys know how the team thing
words.
Works?
I only have a couple words, so I'll get mine over with really fast, Ann. It's just a trail ride. I'm done.
Oh. No, it's way more complicated than that. Do the members on the call understand about how the scoring works for team riding?
I'm not sure. I don't.
Well, you start out with four horses on a team, and your top three times are what counts. So your fastest three horses. Mm-hmm. What you have to think about is the possibility that your fastest horse might get pulled, or maybe even the likelihood, depending on who that is, that horse might get pulled. So you're playing this statistical game the whole time during the competition of how fast your top three horses, and you've always got to calculate it, you're in your fourth horse, how fast they're going relative to the other teams and all the what-ifs. So the statistics can get pretty complicated. This is yet another giant topic. But there are cultural
differences. Especially if you're the chef.
Yeah.
Ann has been a chef.
There are cultural differences in the way different countries ride. And that factors in, and the example has been the French team that has government funding through their betting, national, you know, funding, because they've got nationalized horse racing, socialized horse racing, and so they get a lot of money from the government, and they have paid staff and basically paid riders and breed horses and all train together, and so they have an actual real-life team. Americans, on the other hand, were spread all over the country, were very independent-minded, and it's hard to get people to work together. Imagine that.
Huh.
So those are the extremes that I know of. And then you have the racing stables in UAE and you know, other countries that are more organized and have more financing than we do in America. But you have to look at what you're up against there. Like the French riders generally will ride at least two together, if not all four or six horses that are entered in a race together, like in a group. And they all support each other, and they all know each other and ride well together and have trained together, and that's normal. We Americans don't do that as well, and, you know, for a multitude of reasons. So what we try to do is pick people, personality-wise, that are willing and able to function as a team member, and then horses that are strong and fit and likely to succeed as a team member, a horse, and take it from there. And there's a lot of different ways that you can approach having a rabbit out front. If you want to have somebody that might go have an excellent time and running the risk of lameness or a metabolic pull, but might lead people on and potentially run them into the dirt,
mm-hmm.
if they get all caught up in the moment. And then the opposite extreme is an anchor or a turtle that might be your fourth horse that's not doing a terrible job, but by golly, they're going to finish and they're going to have a really honorable time. And if some of the front runners get pulled, you still have a good overall team time.
Mm-hmm.
What we've also done in the past is have non-team riders. Like say you have six American horses entered and you have four of those as team horses and then two other horses, you could say, okay, you not team individual riders, go out there and blow them out and try to win the thing, and if you get pulled, you get pulled, but meanwhile you probably took some other people down with you. Or you can have those individual riders supporting your team riders and say, okay, individual rider, you're going to go out there and ride with team rider B, and you're going to support that person, and that's your goal all the way through this ride. You're going to change who's leading. You're going to babysit each other. And the main goal is to get that team horse the fastest time it can get. So there's all these different things that play into it. And there can be experienced riders that are riding as individuals with not very experienced riders on the team, and then those people can help each other out. And if it's a bad combination, they can hurt each other. So there's a lot of different things to think about in that sort of a plan. But I can tell you, it's hard to pull it together with the Americans sometimes. A lot of that's based on geography and personality.
I think one of the things that Anne is really brilliant at, actually, is reading people and being able to say, okay, this person is going to, quote, go for it. And therefore, I have to ask myself, you know, is this the right person to put on the team, even though, you know, the person may win, or the person may be pulled at the second check, you know. And Anne has a very good record of who she picks, I think.
And, you know, people say what they think you want to hear. That's just because we're all human. They say the thing that will be most pleasing to the person they're talking to a lot of the time. And you have to filter through that and see what's really true and what's not. Mm-hmm. So that can be tough. What people think they want and what they think they can do often aren't necessarily true. So it can be really, really complicated to get through all of this information and try to put a team together.
So plus you have, I guess, then to work really with the personalities, when you talk about personalities, because there's got to be, when you get to that level, egos that really might take over as well. Is that,
yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah. Or people just falling apart. I mean, we see.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That.
Oh, yeah. There's people, you know, the sobbing wet noodles in the corner. You know, it's like you've got to pull those people together and get them back on the horse. And it's amazing. 100 miles
people
is a long
way. People who ate watermelon for their diet the day before the ride.
Yep.
Some people. Anyhow. Supposed to eat good stuff. Complex carbs.
Right. So it'll be, I think we have a really good group going to Kentucky. It'll be fun because there's a couple of people that are relatively new in the sport and then a lot of really experienced people, and I think it'll be a great combination.
I actually am pretty impressed with pretty much everybody from this country who's going.
Yeah, it's a good list.
Yeah. Okay, other logistics, and we're sort of coming in on this just about the right amount of time. Trailering, crewing, camping, you name it. And I'd love to have Ann Ayala on for this. But Ann Stewart, I'm going to rely primarily on you.
What are we talking about?
The trailering piece and... In some senses, I was thinking the camping in Kentucky, as best as you know it, because I'm trying to pump you for information, quite honestly. But
camping off-site, you mean?
Well, let's just start with the trailering, which is not Kentucky-specific. That's just, you know, logistics of trailering and, you know, what is it that you do when you trailer? And I'll throw on the table that I know with Steig and I, we generally try not to do more than 12 hours a day and try to keep it to 10, and we'll get the horses off twice during that period of time to stretch and eat some grass and offer them water and stuff like that. And that's like 15.
Well, you know, they've studied all these different ways of doing things, and, you know, you'll read that it's optimal to get the horses off every 4 hours, and you know, I just don't think that's realistic. I'm probably more of a, if you want to stop a couple of times, like you're saying, Cheryl, fine, maybe once. There are a lot of people that just go, and their horses do well, and a lot of that depends on the horse's personality. But the main thing to realize is that trailering is an athletic event. They're not resting back there. It is like standing on a trampoline in an earthquake the whole time. It's pretty intense. And most horses get to the venue dehydrated. They have respiratory stress. They're immunosuppressed. They've been inhaling ammonia and dust. You know, it's a really tough time for them in the trailer for most horses. And Cheryl, I know you have the big, usually a giant box stall scenario with loose horses in there. Do you still trailer that way?
We do not use partitions, but if the horse is alone, we'll let him go in the whole unpartitioned trailer.
Uh-huh.
If you've got more than one horse, they get tied.
Okay.
Can I butt in? Because we really do a lot of trailering. And this is just a fun story. We were out at the Race of Champions in Utah with three horses, and we had them in three box stalls, and we were driving. We are the straight through group. I mean, our feeling is we're torturing them, so let's make it as short a torture as we can make it. So we're driving back from Utah to Vermont, and we stop at some rest stop, you know, and gas up and grab a bite to eat, and you know the horses always have water and hay, and now Slurpees in front of them, so you know they have what they need, but still it's unpleasant for them. We came back to the trailer and one of the horses was missing. We thought, oh my God, and we jump up on the side of the trailer and the horse is lying down taking a nap. So
okay,
you're right, Anne. It depends on the personality of the horse. Our horses are so used to trailering. They're just so used to it. And I think to us, the single biggest thing is don't trailer alone if you can possibly avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
We always try to have at least two horses in the trailer. We never, ever, ever tie unless it's a serious biter, because we want them to be able to get their necks stretched out and their head down to the floor.
The most important thing is periodically for their head to get down. So if you don't unload them, at least unhook them if you're tying so they can get their head down. And that's for their respiratory health.
The other thing is we have front and back panels, windows, and we leave those down unless it's really, 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 really bad. So there's a lot of circulation going through there. There's also something to consider. It's a pelleted bedding to use maybe not in your stalls, but use it possibly in your horse trailer because there's no dust. So that's another way to cut down on their respiratory stress. And I'm done.
If you're going to have the windows open, I'd like a fly mask on them so they don't get projectiles in their eyeballs. Just something to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's about the only time we do use fly masks is when we're trailering.
Uh-huh.
If we keep the windows down, and we similar with Dinah, we have front and back drop-downs.
Uh-huh.
And believe in serious air circulation. And
I think the unloading and walking around, I worry about the time factor there. So, you know, Dinah's in the just go school, and I think a lot of people will just go.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing is I worry about is horse. I've seen more than one horse get away, and you know, I know that sounds like so. I mean, it's a big risk when you unload a horse near an interstate.
Yes.
It just is.
Well, and if you're at a rest area, the only place for them to go is onto the highway.
Yeah, if we stop, it's stopping knowing we have a paddock.
Right. And spending the night.
Exactly. I mean, that's the... Are you there? I keep losing you. Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Hello?
I can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yeah, now I can hear you. That was weird. Yeah, that's the only time we stop is if we know we have a paddock and our plan is to spend to overnight so that they're out. I mean, I don't even like to overnight when I only have a stall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when we overnight, and we do regularly, we're not marathoners, we try to make sure they've got a paddock so that they can stretch their legs. We don't believe in stalls, and ideally it's a paddock with grass. And when you're out west, finding paddocks with grass is not easy. So it's a luxury in the east that we have.
Yeah, but they have fairgrounds.
Yeah,
so every little town has a place to keep a horse, so that's pretty nice.
Crewing, one thing I will say about crewing at big rides or for big rides is you generally get to the point if you've been in this sport long enough, you get totally paranoid. And you have backups for practically everything, and possibly backups to the backups. But one thing you ought to try to do is always have a spare set of shoes set up for your horse for that ride. So if it's concave with rim pads or and tungsten nails, have them with you.
And then don't get in an argument with the farrier, because I was talking to Jeff about this the other day, because my horse has very strange back feet, and so he wears very strange shoes in the back. So I sort of, this farrier sort of looked at these funny shoes that I handed him to nail on my horse and wanted to get in a discussion about it. And I said to him, don't ask me any questions, just nail it on. And, you know, I'm sure he thought I was the biggest jerk in the world, but there was no room for discussion there. You know, it's just, this is what needs to go on the horse's foot, and you need to have confidence in that, and don't let a farrier that you don't know from Adam talk you into something out in, you know, a vet check. Because all those farriers have opinions, and just like veterinarians, and they will try to talk you into something different. So you have to know what works for you and be confident in that. And, oh, by the way, have an extra one in your back pocket. So they can just nail it on.
Yeah. Donna, you have any tips for crewing?
Well, I just wanted to say that guaranteed your first hold is never going to be as good as you want it to be. You're going to forget something, so bring everything and then bring it again. And it's a real pain. But the piece of rawhide in the third drawer down is what you're going to need. I don't know how to explain it. It's just incredible that you can never remember. You can never bring the right stuff for the first hold. So just bring everything. It's really simple.
And also have somebody that actually knows where it is, so they're not like completely flipping out and decompensating and like ransacking everything.
Knowing where everything is, when you look at the backs of these trucks and they're piled beyond the gunnels.
Yeah, but you know where that piece of rawhide is.
Yeah.
And oh, the other piece on crewing that I think has probably been for me as a crew the biggest help of anything is make friends with the other crews, because they can save you.
That's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually end up working as a team, and we all if any of my crew or Steve's crew or not, any of our crews are out there, they will help anybody who is with them, with Steve. And what I mean is that it's not – it. Whoever's with our guys or with me, they're on our team, and we treat them the same. So if we possibly can, we will supply them with water, with electrolytes, with hay, with grain, with, you know, comfort, whatever we can do for the people riding with our people. And it's done nothing but pay off over the years.
Yeah. And making friends with crew is actually a very useful construct. I know I'm harking back again to the North I guess it was a Pan Am up in Vermont a number of years ago. At the last check, we were looking at, Super was working on some growth sores, and kind of looked at it and said, oh, I don't know what to do about this. Does anybody have any Easy Glide? Nobody had any Easy Glide. And somebody mentioned talcum powder. And it's like, yeah, that would be good. Anybody have talcum powder? And Larry Canady had talcum powder. So we pop it all over the girth, and it was fine. But at the same time, it's like, it's really great to be able to, you know, just kind of go to other crew people. And, you know, it is sort of an extended team, which is really wonderful. So it's when you don't have that piece of rawhide from the third drawer down, but somebody else does.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Let me get a little bit onto something that's a little bit more Kentucky specific. Camping at most ride sites is primitive, and I think we all know that, and we all go there prepared. What's the camping going to be like in Kentucky? Are we allowed to camp?
No. I mean, there's camp.
Are you talking about this year or next year?
This is this year.
This year, okay. With you, there's a campground there.
Yeah. And they said
with water and septic. Yeah. Electricity.
Yeah.
And they've
but
got hookups and everything. But there, then there's.
But the horses can't be there. The horses have to go into the barn.
Right. But the sort of the impression I had was that even the people are not allowed to stay in their rigs there.
Oh no. There's a big campground there.
But we are allowed to stay in the rigs.
Yeah.
Ah.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know where you got that information, but there's a.
Okay.
I do. I know where she got it. She got the amazing lack of information that anybody has gotten.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been supplying information to some of the foreign teams because they have had zero information.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's unfortunate.
It is Carol Giles, but that's it. And it's like, come on, folks.
And I have to say, I'm working the ride next week, and I haven't been told where to go or where to meet or what time. Yeah, well, you know, if there's going to be a pre-ride or anything like that. And I'm supposed to do a work day on Sunday, and I haven't been given any information as to.
If it's any consolation, when I spoke with her earlier today, Ann Ayala hadn't either.
Okay, well, that actually does make me feel better.
And what is she? She's on the ground jury?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and she's supposed to be there on Sunday, and it's like, okay, she's gone to the website for the Kentucky Horse Park,
mm-hmm.
And somebody said that either Emmett or Jan Stevens had just sent out a site map, like, today.
Yeah, I just got those emails, like, this morning. And I think, was it a site map? I thought it was a map to Walmart or something. I can't remember. I didn't know.
There was stuff that was...
A map to restaurants? Yeah.
To restaurants and to Walmart and to grocery stores. That stuff did come out. Carol forwarded it over. I still haven't seen a real site map for things that are pertinent to us.
You know, I haven't either, but it's terrible. I mean, you pull into that little, there's a little guard station when you pull into the horse park, and they'll tell you where to go. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine, I mean, it's just a big loop drive around the park.
It's pretty expansive, at least based on what I've managed to look at the horse park site map or website rather. And like that's probably
a huge place.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm sure Anne will be sending out maps to those lucky people under her care. So
yes.
If I had one, I'd sure send it to you.
No, you will in time. I mean, I hope.
You know what I'm going to do is we'll just try to get a phone list together this week and kind of take it from there.
You're going to call me in Tokyo.
No, but I'll put your phone number out.
By the way, don't hang up after this call because I got to ask you something.
Okay.
Anyhow, I think that just about covers it for primary stuff. Rick and Dana, you have any other things that you want to throw on the table?
I actually just wanted to clarify something because when you were talking about trailering, so when you're just driving along, if there's not another horse in the trailer, you just leave them loose and they ride fine?
Yeah.
Okay. I've never heard that before. So, you're always taught when you're growing up that they have to stand a certain way, but they're actually much better that way.
Well,
actually, they've done studies on that, Dana. They've done studies on what a horse left to its own devices, which way they'll choose to stand,
mm-hmm.
and it is not facing forward.
Yeah.
It's actually very individual, is my understanding. Some like to go one way, and some like to go another way.
Mm-hmm. And they usually vote for
change halfway through.
But that's how the whole slant load concept came about, is they'll usually stand at a 45-degree angle or so or completely backwards.
Mm-hmm. I have a slant load, but I'm going to Florida next spring, and I just, and I've been actually fretting it because, you know, it's 600 or 700 miles. I know for some of you all that's not a long way, but for me it is, and I just, I've been really concerned about that. But it would be great if I could just, you know, not worry about stopping, go straight through, and just, you know, let him loose in the back.
If you have to turn your trailer wide enough, or they won't jackknife in there.
No, he can turn completely around.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and it's fine. It's fine because I've taken everything out. I've taken, you know, it's a slant load, but I've taken the tack room out. I just like to have it as big and open as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Dana, here's the thing that I would suggest.
I got tied up at work.
One of the things I'd suggest is make sure you tape up with duct tape and any kind of, you know, the foam that goes around pipes,
mm-hmm.
Insulation. I would use some of that maybe and duct tape it on to anything that's sticking out into the trailer, you know, like the little knobs that are.
Yeah.
I would make sure those are well padded.
Okay.
And the other thing is I would do some experimenting. If it was two horses in the trailer, I'd say not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But one horse traveling alone, you know, they can get a little shaky about their well-being.
Uh-huh.
And so you might want to just do some shorter trips with him loose,
mm-hmm.
and get used to him also moving around back there, because it's a little odd when they go turning around.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, do a little experimenting and see if that works for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
Certainly what you could do is if you really just don't trust them, and there's a way to rig your slant loads so that you can, you know, keep them stalled while you're moving, and then if you stop, like say you stop to get gas or something,
mm-hmm.
and to grab a, you know, a meal, you can swing that partition out of the way so that he can turn around and stretch and drop his head, and you know he's still in his own environment, and you're not risking him by having him out on the road or falling on the tailgate or doing whatever stupid things they do,
mm-hmm.
but you know, you also might not have to worry so much that he's, you know, going to try to climb out a window or something.
Yeah, that makes sense. Good thoughts. That's all I had.
Okay, Stag, you want to throw a 2 cents in on any of the topics?
Well, I did join them in the last time. We've certainly done 600 or 700 miles and. In one day, but I didn't hear, you know, what led up to it. And when we have a single horse, we let it sort of run loose, and doesn't seem to have been an issue, but every horse is different. You know, Super, I think, doesn't travel as well as Trubin did, and since he'll tend to be pickier about eating and all that, and we like to, you know, offer him some sort of, you know, but one thing I think, is this already got mentioned, stop me, but one thing I think is important is they're having plenty of opportunity to keep hay or something in their belly, so that it's probably one of your best preventions of ulcers is just, you know, every 2 to 3 hours they have a chance to get something in their belly so it's not sitting there empty. Which we get them off, but not everybody does that. That has its both upsides and downsides.
Yeah, we hit about on some of those. Anyhow.
One last thing is what I'll tell you what we do with as far as getting something in their bellies. They have hay in front of them all the time, but we also take a we don't normally feed any of this because we basically don't approve, and they love it, so they eat it, and it's good. But anyway, there's not much of it. We take a handful of sweet feed and a handful of beet pulp, and we float it in water. I mean, it's wet. I mean, it's not like you can even see it. And then that's in front of them all the time with some Performan Win electrolytes in it. And they'll munch away on it and keep wet stuff going through them.
Mm-hmm.
Before you get on to that, Stag, I was talking with Carol Giles today from Pacific North, and she said that they do something rather similar. I think it's more carrots, apples, 2 inches of water, some beet pulp, and then they throw oats on top. And the horses get accustomed to that early on in their life. She acclimates that them to that mixture almost from the get-go. And so that when they get on the trailer, they know that that's what that's it, that what that's about. And they evidently do drink some that way, even while in motion, which sort of blew my mind. She had a video, she traveled with somebody who had a video camera in the back of their trailer and was able to watch, oh, look, they're drinking now again. So it's sort of an interesting thing that the horses will drink and they will eat some while they are in motion.
The other thing we found that they at least will like for a couple of days is a slurry of dingy hay. You know, this hay in a bag that you get that's, you know, fairly chopped up hay, and and it if you mix it with water, it turns into sort of a slurry. And they seem to like that. And again, that gets something that sits in their belly so that they, you know, helps prevent ulcers and all that good stuff.
Okay.
Cool.
I think we got it.
I think we do. Donna, are you and I staying on for a minute?
Yeah, just for a second.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Have a good night, folks.
Okay.
See ya.
If you've got ideas for the next call, holler. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye. What I wanted to mention is I sent Todd and you an email of my schedule.
Uh-huh.
And the big deal is where is he supposed to go? Does he know?
He is just going to go to the campground, and he's going to stay in Meg and Dave's trailer.
Oh, okay. All right. I just didn't know where he was headed. I'm staying at a hotel because Steve won't be there yet. So.
Where are you staying?
The Hilton Garden Inn or the Hilton something.
Okay.
Because that's when we were in Japan, Vanita said that's where she was putting up the officials, and I thought, okay, well, that's as easy as anything. You know, at least I know a name.
Okay.
So it's in Georgetown, and she said it's pretty close. So.
Okay. I'm staying in the Holiday Inn North in Lexington, which I've stayed in before.
Oh, okay. So you may be farther away.
I may be, but
yeah,
it's not far at all. I mean, it's a few miles.
Yeah, I don't think it's any of it's going to be bad. So
yeah.
All right. Well, I just wondered what to do with them, and I can certainly take them to Meg and Dave's, and
we'll all just be wandering around, wondering what the heck we're doing, I think, and then we'll figure it out, and it'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I can pick them up. Or, you know, if he's coming in anywhere near my 5:30 flight, I'd be delighted to hook up with him.
Okay.
Steve wants to talk to you. No, he doesn't. He's pointing at a phone. Yeah, oh, you have my cell phone, I'm sure.
I do.
I can give it to you again.
Well, why don't you just...
You ready?
Yeah, because I think I've got an old number in my phone, but I think
that's you. It. It's 603-219. 9286.
Okay.
And you know, he'll probably email me and say, yeah, I can meet you, or I'm not getting in until 12. And I say, you're on your own, my dear, because I will have been flying all night. So.
Right. Yeah, we'll figure something out. I'll be in touch with him.
Yeah.
Sometimes he gets these flurries of actually responding, and then other times he doesn't respond at all.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so glad he's coming. That'll be fun. And you know about the Yankee swap.
I do. I have to remember to bring something.
Whew. And we got to remember that Todd knows about it. So
okay.
I think I told him, or somehow he knew. Anyway.
Okay.
So that's cool.
All right. Well, have a good trip.
Yeah, we will. And Steve, does Steve need to know anything other than what you sent?
I don't think so. That's all I know.
Well, I was just shocked because at the first meeting they said that we didn't have to be in until Tuesday, and then. It's back to Tuesday again? Oh, okay. And then they switched it to Monday, and now they switched it back to Tuesday?
Yeah, but
okay.
Tuesday by 9 a.m., you've got to be settled into the Marne, which means...
Yeah, that's what I heard. All right.
You better get there early.
Yeah, I know. Well, we're just 10 minutes away, but it, the more time those horses can be out, the less I worry about tie-ups. So
I know it.
That's our only worry. So, all right, well, it'll be fun. We'll have fun no matter what.
Absolutely.
Just a trail ride. I didn't mean to downgrade that, but
well, they
everybody
needs to calm down about the big rides because it is just a day.
Yeah.
Hopefully,
we'll
it's
have
a good day though.
Yeah, I'm planning to have a good time, and I know you are too. So we will.
Okay.
And
I'll try to scare up a voodoo doll or two, just in case.
Well, yeah, we need and your hats.
Oh,
think you can get Todd to wear an odd hat.
I don't know. He's an odd hat anyway. So.
He is an odd hat. All right. We'll talk to you soon. Be
okay.
Well.
All right. Hi to Steve.
I will.
Okay. Bye.